Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Brian Kelly joins us today from San Francisco. He is general manager of the San Francisco Tech Lab for the Association for Manufacturing Technology, better known as AMT, a nonprofit trade group established 120 years ago to strengthen the U.S. industrial base through the application of manufacturing technology. He also represents AMT as a founding member of the Onshoring Project, a supply chain consortium whose mission is to facilitate a paradigm shift in sourcing by promoting sounder and more financially beneficial strategies of using lean-performing North American suppliers. And prior to AMT, Ryan held product operations and biz dev roles in the startup ecosystem at MakeTime and later at Xometry after MakeTime was acquired by Xometry. And before that, he worked in consulting, helping major B2B tech OEMs like HP and Xerox create service business to bundle with their hardware. Ryan, it's great to see you here in Austin a few weeks ago waving the manufacturing flag. So we got lots to bring on the podcast and chat about today when it comes to manufacturing innovation. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Ty. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, we always start with backgrounds here, and in my short snippet, of course, never does it justice. But give us more of the color commentary on your journey, which led you from manufacturing startup life to now leading the tech lab for AMT.
Well, so with MakeTime and later with Xometry, we were members of AMT, the Association for Manufacturing Technology. When we were pretty early, I think it was pre-Series A, where we first approached the AMT because, we were fundraising and investors had a lot of questions about, our market sizing. At that time, we were selling surplus capacity on CNCs. That's the sort of the story that we were selling. The investors were asking, well, just how many CNC machines are there? Only AMT had that information. And with AMT, with the data that they were able to share with us, we were able to build up a really credible install base. And from that, we were able to build up our market sizing, made the investors happy and, felt like we were really solid in the way that we were thinking about things and had good information. And that was the beginning of my relationship with the AMT that continued for several years. We participated in their events like IMTS and the MFG meeting, MT Forecast. And when they were looking for someone to open up their first ever West Coast facility, they recruited me for that. I guess the thinking was sort of bilingual, right? I mean, MakeTime and Xometry's customers were the traditional manufacturers and machine shops that is AMT's bread and butter. And then, of course, we were a tech company, doing interesting things with computational engineering or computational geometry, crunching big data, doing a lot of sort of new things on the tech side within the manufacturing technology space that hadn't get done. So I think AM was sort of thinking that I had the sort of the right mix of background to be able to tie what we were doing here in Silicon Valley to tell the right story to the sort of the techies, but also connect what we were learning here in Silicon Valley back to sort of our traditional base.
Yeah, well, it's a perfect fit, and we could only use 10x more of that blended hybrid background, however we want to define it. And it's going to be the topic of this discussion, how we tie all these ecosystems together. And as a former GE Ventures investor in Xometry, you guys definitely had your market data game together. So shout out to AMT. I didn't know that part of the story. Well, speaking of AMT, maybe just for some of our listeners, help set a little foundation. Give us a little bit more high-level data points about AMT generally and the role that the tech lab you're running plays specifically, to use your words, making connections between the manufacturing and technology communities.
Yeah, so AMT, again, it's the Association for Manufacturing Technology. So we're a member-based nonprofit trade association. And our members are companies that make some kind of technology product that manufacturers use. So Fanuc robots, Mazak CNC machines, Autodesk with their CAD software, these are examples of AMT members. But like a Caterpillar or a Boeing, that wouldn't be, sort of they wouldn't qualify for membership with AMT. They're an end user of manufacturing technology, but they themselves are not creating some sort of manufacturing technology and taking it to market. So the organization is really old. It's 120 years old. It started as the American Machine Tool. So, you know, CNCs, you know, before there were computers, right? So machine tools. The trade group that emerged to work for the benefit of that industry. At that time, it was really a lobbying organization. So lobbying the government to create policies that were going to be more favorable to domestic manufacturing so that American manufacturers would buy more American machine tools. So over that long history, there's been a lot of changes. Those changes are really because of the innovations happening in technology. So CNC came along, but then later robotics came along, and then, you know, CAD systems and a lot of other technologies that both support the kind of the machining space, but then also things like additive manufacturing that were sort of new manufacturing technologies that didn't have anything to do, you know, with CNC machining. So like, I think around the 90s, we really expanded, you know, the name of the organization and the mission of the organization to be every sort of manufacturing technology. And so now our members include, you know, companies that work in motion control, that work in design, engineering, robotics, IoT, you know, ERP systems, like really pretty broad range of technologies there. Being 120 years old and sort of the legacy that we have, and I think, you know, most people would agree that manufacturing as an industry is sort of tech laggards, and I think that's going to be, you know, a subject of this conversation. You know, AMT and specifically our president, Doug Wood, said, you know, if we want to be around for another several decades, you know, we need to be ahead. You know, we want our organization to reflect what, you know, 2030 manufacturing is going to look like and not, you know, what the sort of the status quo is in the industry today. And that was really the thinking behind having a dedicated resource here in Silicon Valley. Obviously, innovation isn't only happening here, but there's such a high concentration of companies and capital and talent here. And I mean, not a week goes by that I'm not meeting another interesting founder, another interesting investor that's working in the space. So there's a lot happening here. And, you know, it's not just startups. There's, you know, name brand, you know, marquee companies out here like NVIDIA, like Google. You could even consider Apple in this same space that the traditional manufacturing space doesn't necessarily think of them as manufacturing technology companies, but that's how they see themselves. And they see this as a strategic market where they can really expand their business. So in, you know, NVIDIA, I think two of the last three keynotes of their big annual conference, their CEO has spoken at length about their strategy in the manufacturing and industrial space. You know, Google or Alphabet has rolled out Intrinsic, which is a industrial robotics software company. And, you know, Apple, they work hand in hand with lots of manufacturing companies to utilize iPads and even Apple watches in industrial environments. So this is all happening, and AMT really exists to help companies like that perform better in the market.
Yeah, well, I don't think anything other than COVID highlighting to consumers just what you pointed out about Apple and NVIDIA, right? Still the manufacturing supply chain process underneath the hood there. And AMT, 120 years, that's incredible. The staying power, the adaptability. And I will give a plug, because I know I'm already pre-programming it forward. For all of our listeners, if you've not been to an IMTS conference associated to manufacturing, it's the one to be at. And I think, Ryan, next year is in Chicago in September. Is that right? Spot check me.
Yeah, that's right. Let me pull up the exact date. And I'd be, you know, remiss to say, it's like, you know, that's what we're most famous for is our, you know, giant trade show. It's one of the world's largest trade shows, IMTS, mm-hmm. the International Manufacturing Technology Show. It's 1.5 million square feet of, I mean, it's like Disney for manufacturing nerds, basically.
Takes like the whole McCormick Center up. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all of McCormick, and I'm looking at the website now. So it's always in mid-September. I think it is.
And while you pull that up, I just say from going over a decade.
September 9th. Go ahead. September 9th to 14th in 2024. So we hold it every other year. It's such a big show and everyone's bringing all their gear that it'd be impossible to do it every year. So we do it every other year on the even years.
Right on. Well, wanted to get a plug in there for at least almost a decade now, and to see the amount of innovation being plugged into the show, and that's a broad term, but I'm excited for next year. So we'll see everyone there. But let's get some of the questions kicked off here. And I want to start us off here, kind of more of a macro, the state of U.S. manufacturing chat, if we could, and then work our way into some more specific topics. And you specifically are out there talking to a very broad variety of companies and stakeholders across the manufacturing ecosystem every day, including when we were sitting in Austin building ecosystem. And thus, you're very well positioned to help us take a pulse of what U.S. manufacturing looks like today. Some data here. Earlier this year, I think it was reported the U.S. manufacturing activity fell to its lowest level in nearly 3 years. And S&P Global data showed that the U.S. manufacturing sector fell into contraction territory in May. But at the same time, we're also seeing, very contradictory to that, we're seeing billions of dollars go into major projects to manufacture batteries, solar cells, semiconductors, et cetera. I could go on, in part due to the Inflation Reduction Act and some other government programs. So, point being, take us behind the numbers here as to what does seem contradictory at the surface level. What are you seeing and hearing in the field when it comes to where we're at in U.S. manufacturing today?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'm not really sure I have a great answer to it. But I think, share some, you know, sort of anecdotes of the things that I'm hearing. I mean, certainly there is, I don't want to call them conflicting signals, but there's a variety of signals that kind of suggest different things. So AMT, we have a whole research department and some economists on staff, and we do some syndicated proprietary research. One of the things that we track are the shipments of manufacturing technology orders. And what we saw with the most recent one that we've just published, which came out in June, I think we put this out quarterly, is that this is, it's like you said, we know that the orders have slowed down. Year to year, we're sort of doing better than we have. So it looks like things are recovering somewhat. But it doesn't really jive with, you know, the amount of investment that's going into huge capital investments for new factory fit up, direct foreign investment in new facilities over here. And basically what we're seeing in the reshoring trend in general, which is a real thing. And it's happening in a big way. It's happening quickly. Absolutely. When I talk to manufacturers, you know, mostly who I'm talking to are small and medium-sized manufacturing companies, less than 200 employees. That's the vast majority of manufacturers out there. They're really busy. And they're busy because of the labor constraint. And so if it's true that we're in a bit of a slow moment, but we see some leading indicators with the reshoring and with the sort of new investments in domestic production, then, you know, there's sort of like a tidal wave approaching. And it would appear that we are constrained on the labor side primarily, with our ability as an industrial base to deal with this surge of demand.
Yeah, and when we talk about, you know, technology adoption associated to what I'm 100% in your camp, the wave is building. We don't need another nearshoring, reshoring article, or we know the geopolitical attention is driving that. So the question, somewhat related, is there's a difference between, is the technology ready or is the spend and the budget allocation ready, right? You mentioned manufacturing somewhat being a laggard to adopt technology. I grew up a couple generations of family-owned manufacturing businesses. I'm aligned with you there again, but it seems like we've really been plowing a lot of foundation the last decade alone. Venture has been a part of that topic of this podcast. When you think about that, is the tech ready versus is the commercialization and the budget there ready? Where do you kind of lean on that topic as well?
Yeah, so I think that I don't think that we have an innovation problem. I think that we have an adoption problem. I would say that, you know, over the past few decades, there's been some, you know, underinvestment, right, in technology. This was sort of a result of a few things. There was the Great Recession that kind of, you know, came along, and that sort of negatively impacted manufacturing companies' ability to invest at the same cadence that they were used to. Then there was, you know, sort of the increased movement of production to low-cost countries, particularly China and other Asian countries, that put more pressure on domestic manufacturers to do things cheaper. All the while, we've been dealing with this labor shortage and not really filling the top of the funnel. And then at the same time, the pace of technology innovation is accelerating. I mean, we know that from, you know, what we're seeing in the consumer space, but, you know, similar thing is happening on the industrial side as well. And so, you know, manufacturers, most of which I already pointed out, are small to medium-sized businesses. They don't have a lot of profit. They don't have a lot of cash reserves. They are know that there is an abundance of technology available. They look at their environment and they just say, well, I could upgrade here, I could upgrade here, I could upgrade here. And they don't necessarily know where they can even get started. And there's not a well-worn playbook for this type of thing either, which is, you know, that in itself could be a topic for another podcast. So that's kind of the situation that manufacturers find themselves in. But then if they do decide that they want to do something, today, all technology sort of gets implemented through some kind of systems integrator, value-added reseller, you know, some sort of channel. There's not a lot of sort of going direct and sort of doing it yourself at this point in this industry. And that is a costly endeavor, and it's a time-consuming endeavor. So with all sort of the barriers to adoption that I already mentioned, even if they sort of get past those and decide that they want to adopt, it's a steep climb, you know, to then be able to say, okay, well, any sort of meaningful, sort of significant technology adoption is going to be sort of a six-figure, multi-month thing, and hopefully then at the end of it, I'll have something that works. I think that things are really changing, and that today that paradigm is quickly slipping away. But there's maybe like some PTSD there in the industry about what buying technology really looks like and feels like. And so it's intimidating to a lot of these companies, and they need help now. The last thing I'll mention, and this is, I think, the, you know, the most important aspect of this challenge, is the labor shortage. Even if they, like, let's say there was capital allocated for a project, and they found a product that they want, a systems integrator that they want to work with, Well, they might not have the personnel internally that can be the point person for these technology implementations because everybody is so busy. And they might not have the people in-house that have the skills to take on some kind of software or IoT or some kind of smart manufacturing technology or a robotics implementation. So that's a big problem, right? Because I think some of these financial issues that we can, they have to invest. And I think the government is going to put some incentives in place that make it easier to do so. There's already some pilot projects that the federal government is rolling out, similar to the sort of the loan programs that they were, rolling out during the pandemic that allowed companies to take out loans that were sort of forgiven if they met certain requirements. Well, they're piloting that same thing with robots so that, yes, we're going to loan you this money, but if you check these boxes, then we're going to forgive that loan over time as a way to get more robots into American factories. I think that's a terrific idea. The problem is what if you don't have anybody in your factory that is sort of able to wrap their head around that and able to dedicate the time to make sure that these sort of implementations are done effectively. So it's a big challenge. You look at the situation and you say, well, there's a labor shortage, we need more robots. But what not enough people understand is that, and this is, I think, would be true with any sort of big change management project in any sort of company, is that you actually need to take the time and take some resource to invest in this future state that you want. And manufacturers today may not have the ability to do that, even though they really need to. And so this is a big near-term obstacle that we're going to need to overcome if we're going to have more tech in our factories.
Yeah, well, I think you've really nailed it when it kind of covers the macro piece too. This all comes down, and we've been preaching it at least for a decade, just on the venture side alone, it really all comes down to the talent available to implement and deploy this stuff internally. And, I think the thing that's different to your comment from a decade ago, per se, we always talk about pilot purgatory or whatever it may be, but it's to the point now they have to invest. I mean, just the labor shortage, skills, productivity gap, all the things, again, we've been discussing for a long time. I'm watching it with our portfolio. They know they have to invest at this point. The unfortunate part is they've put the budget there, they're ready to go, but it comes back again to your point of the talent. And so maybe I'll pause, put a bookmark on the talent piece, because we're going to come back to how do we help build that ecosystem, bring more talent into our sector. But before that, I wanted to quickly hit kind of like a layered down from the macro. You know, you're a part of the onshoring effort at AMT, but let's move us forward and talk about what's not an entirely new thing per se, but it's an unquestionable shift that we're seeing accelerate faster and faster with both U.S. reshoring and nearshoring in LATAM. And I don't think anyone who follows industrial news writ large these days, you constantly see in headlines on the topic of nearshoring specifically, along with the rise of LATAM as a major player in the industrial supply chain. And Mexico in particular is an emerging example as a significant force that's shaping North American production and trade, and the data all backs this up. I think a few points to call out with Morgan Stanley study from June projecting that nearshoring has the potential to boost Mexican manufacturing exports to the U.S. from $455 billion today to an estimated $609 billion in just 5 years from now. In our own shop here at Iron Spring Ventures, we've been looking at this trend for a while and have an investment in Mexico City, Solvento, with logistics involved. But we released some of our own nearshoring analysis that just really plugs the fact that I personally don't believe the U.S. gets its reshoring act in line where we want it to be, unless nearshoring in Mexico and all the production efforts down there equally parallel those efforts. So that's my opinion. We got to do both at the same time. And so then you guys finally piling in here, I think it was in August, AMT and the Mexican Association of Mold, Dye, and Tool Manufacturing signed an MOU to enhance technological acumen among Mexican companies and their employees in order to strengthen the manufacturing tech in Mexico. So that's a mouthful, I know, but the large companies, small companies, consumers, governments, et cetera, many organizations all around the world, specifically even US, Mexico, are all adjusting to these different dynamics. So let's dig on this for our community. You're living it with the onshoring group at AMT. How do you see this manufacturing trend playing out over the next decade domestically to fold into the narrative?
Well, I will say that AMT actually has, we have a few global technology centers, and one of the ones that we have is in Monterrey, Mexico, and that's been there for like at least a decade. Mm-hmm. Our other global technology centers are in India and China. We also have a presence in Brazil and in Western Europe, but we have these three sort of bricks and mortar facilities that our members use as they're part of their global expansion. But we've had a presence in Mexico for a long time, and for a long time, we understand the strategic value of our southern neighbor. I agree with everything that you said. The continual investment and reliance and development of Mexico has been increasing for a long time, and certainly with the exodus of a lot of American manufacturing activity from China, clearly Mexico is going to be one of the main beneficiaries of this. We're going to see a lot of reshoring, but there is not, at least in the mind of a lot of the companies that are currently sourcing in China, not the ability to go straight from a low-cost country like China right back to the United States. And so Mexico has some of the characteristics, lower cost of labor, an established industrial infrastructure, some of these characteristics in common with China, although they might be different in degree. But it has some other advantages, like being a favored trade partner, favorable tax and import-export conditions, and it's a lot closer. It's a lot closer than China. And so this is really a no-brainer from the point of view of a lot of companies that, like I said, are not just evaluating reshoring or nearshoring, but maybe net new production activities. And Mexico looks increasingly attractive, given sort of the global sociopolitical climate right now.
Yeah. Well, we need to figure out something to get down to Monterrey together and bring some folks with us, because I think, as you pointed out, it's not slowing down anytime soon. Same signals we're seeing. And it's imperative, again, for that side of the border to do well in order for us to do what we want to do with reshoring. So could have a whole discussion on that one. But I do want to get back to the bookmark we left off on talent, because it's what it always comes down to. And this podcast, we've hit on this multiple times, something that's mission critical and obviously aligned to your efforts at AMT. I think you even showed me a spider web chart at some point of all the different constituencies you're helping bridge together. But we have to build up a robust and diverse ecosystem around manufacturing innovation in the U.S., as we've been talking about. So beyond us advising on how to navigate macroeconomic conditions and forecasting trends with nearshoring, AMT has a much broader mandate to build network across the U.S., with the goal to support a thriving manufacturing industry in the U.S. And a big part of that is furthering innovation, attracting talent, as we just mentioned, and really driving investment into the sector. I like to kind of boil it all down to even my days at GE Ventures and even at Boeing. How do we make manufacturing cool again in some regards? And that's a loose definition, but I'll lob it over to you. How do we get this right? And how is AMT expanding its reach to help build ecosystem all over the country, as you've explained to me?
Yeah, so there's a couple questions there. I'll do my best to try to relate them. The the talent shortage in the manufacturing industry, you know, it's been decades in the making. And, you know, you don't walk 5 miles into a forest and expect to, you know, walk 2 miles out, right? It's like this is a problem decades in the making. It's going to take decades to repair it. And it needs to be, we need to have sort of like a concerted effort. Governments got to get involved. Large corporations need to get involved and make it a priority. Although I do think that there are some interesting things happening, that sort of the timing might be right for more young people, techie sort of people, to get involved in manufacturing. One thing, making stuff is cool. And the sort of the sexiest industries of like the last decade that it seemed like, you know, smart young people were trying to become a part of were like basically the Googles and the Facebooks, you know, of the world, and finance. Well, I think that, you know, and I'm sort of talking, Ty, about sort of people that maybe graduated from college around the time that you and I did.
Sure.
But I think the, you know, the kids that are in high school or in college now that are idealistic and, you know, want to do something with their career and their talent to shape the world, they definitely don't want to work for, you know, social media companies or any sort of company that's sort of based on this kind of advertising model. You know, finance isn't as attractive because it doesn't really look like it's making a positive contribution to the world. And so, you know, it being a kind of a characteristic of this new generation that they want to sort of use their talents for good, I'm saying, like, well, look at the manufacturing industry. You know, you get to be a part of this sort of resurgence, revitalization of our industrial base. Everyone, and that's one of the reasons I've stayed in the manufacturing space for so long, is I feel good. And when I tell people that I work in this industry, you know, they're like, you know, good on you, man. That's great that you're sort of working in this space, because they think that it's a respectable thing and you can have pride in it. And the other thing is, I think, you know, especially as the robotics, additive manufacturing space, and to a certain extent, sort of, AR, VR, you know, these things, as they become more pervasive in the popular context, I think it's pretty obvious about, that there's a lot of interesting, really techie sort of opportunities in the industrial sector. And I think that's going to be more attractive to people. So I think that there's a bit of a natural evolution that's happening, and that's going to sort of push it in that direction, but it's not enough. You know, we need to, I think the government needs to put some incentives in place, some programs in place, to make it so that we get the smartest people in the areas of industry where we need them the most. I don't know exactly what that looks like. I mean, there's been talk about some, you know, manufacturing core, kind of similar to American core, more formal apprentice programs, more kind of co-op relationships, getting more people out of high school and into trade programs, things like that. But, you know, it's definitely a serious problem.
Yeah, it's going to take all solutions. And, you know, somewhere that I am very encouraged, and I'm actually really appreciative of the venture community, you know, obviously supporting through founders. But in order to attract and retain the talent, there has to be a level of digitization involved in their daily work life. You know, these are digital mm-hmm. natives. You know, shout out to some examples in and out of the portfolio. In ours, we have Copia. There's GitHub for all the people that are working at GitHub or at Google and Amazon, et cetera. Well, we still, at a controls engineer level, we still programmable logic controllers with software. Why don't they have modern DevOps tools like what Copia is trying to build? Or out of the portfolio, mm-hmm. something like Tulip, who's actually trying to say, we have a skilled worker problem where we're going to lose a lot of knowledge transfer pretty quick, and we better figure a way to digitize it and democratize whatever's in Susie's head, because she's really good at what she's doing, but we need to democratize that to everyone else who learns. And I think Tulip, with their digital work instructions and how they think about MES, point being many solutions, but if we don't drive more of a digital enabled work environment, and that's not to say occupations are going away. I think that's a very careful definition we always have to talk about with automation. It's just the activities within an occupation are going to change, and they're going to go away from being analog and being more digitally oriented, which is a good thing for everyone. Higher paying, higher skilled 21st century occupations that have different activities. So in my soapbox, yeah. But I think a big part of what you're doing.
My comment there is that I think, you know, there's a bit of a chicken and egg thing, but I think that there's a potential for a positive reinforcing feedback loop there. Right. What's it going to take for those sort of solutions to get into factories? It's going to be young people that just know stuff about computers. Frankly, young, uppity, idealistic people that are going to come in and be like, well, isn't there a better way that we can do this? And then they're going to find it, and then they're going to be that change agent. You know, I don't see a lot of company owners of that older generation saying, we really got to optimize and, you know, become more digital, right? I mean, they've got something that works, and, you know, retirement might be right around the corner for them. It's going to take getting that, you know, a couple people of that new generation in to be able to reimagine how a lot of these things can be done better with software. I mean, if you look at all other industries and in terms of like what they're paying like on SaaS, and you compare that to the manufacturing industry in the typical shop, I mean, it's night and day. I don't have the exact figures there. I don't know if anyone's actually done that study. But I mean, if you just look in your own life of the amount of SaaS that you use and you compare that to, you know, what manufacturers are doing, it's relatively low. I actually think that there's a huge opportunity there. And it's not just on the shop floor side. I think it's in the sort of front, middle office type solutions. In addition to the more production side solutions, but it's the whole suite, and it's the whole stack from the infrastructure level, you know, getting access to broadband internet, cybersecurity, firewalls, being able to implement IoT, all the way up to the tip top of, you know, having real quality CRM and analytics on customer engagement, things like that. The big opportunity all throughout that environment for manufacturers to take advantage of technology and for solution providers to be able to sell into that market, which is a hungry market, if it is indeed a little bit strapped for cash and bad at adopting technology.
Yeah, solutions all across the board. And I'd only pile on my last comment here about the generational transition that is happening. Again, 10 years in, this is happening way faster than I've ever seen it before, where we are watching, call it the proverbial keys to the operations being passed down to, you know, fourth generation, fifth generation. And they certainly know, as digital natives themselves, in a lot of ways, if they want to have a seventh generation or an eighth generation, and our network's made up a lot of these industrial family offices that own and operate a big conglomerate in this country, the digitization is going to be a key factor for them doing that. It will not be some big disruption's going to take over our business. That's the last thing you'd ever get to sell into any of these groups. But the innovation does help drive advancements, right, and the maturity of the business model. So I'll end it there. Lots of promising tailwinds behind it. But Ryan, we always love to wrap up with a little bit of a quick hitter Q&A. So if you're ready, we'll jump in.
I'm ready.
All right. Number one thing, whenever you're talking to a founder as you go across the country that you're evaluating when you say this person knows how to build in this ecosystem, what would that be?
So I think that there's a lot of people out there that know how to build good technology. And I'm super excited about the innovative solutions that have real high impact potential in the space. So that's not really what I'm looking for. I mean, look, I love tech demos. I love looking under the hood. But I think the most important thing that is going to differentiate a founder that is going to be successful versus one that's not, is to really understand how hard this market is and how your go-to-market strategy needs to be responsive to this environment. You know, your customer isn't on the internet all day, right? They're not going to be as susceptible to these sort of digital advertising techniques that so many companies rely on. How are you going to deal with that? That's what I want to know. And the founders that I think have a more cavalier attitude towards that and don't really consider how difficult it's going to be and haven't figured out how they are going to actually get in front of those customers, then that would be a sort of the first talk I have with them, is to, you know, really get them to understand that it's going to be about 10 times as difficult as they think it's going to be.
What is one resource, book, podcast, blog, whatever you'd recommend our audience to follow in this ecosystem?
Well, you know, that's really difficult because there's a lot of real smart people that are writing and commenting on this space. And I love a lot of the economic point of views. I love all of sort of the reporting on the tech that gets made. AMT, you know, does a fantastic job of covering those issues. And so if you're not familiar with the stuff that we do, you should go and check out our website, sign up for our newsletter, watch some of our videos and stuff. But the thing that really interests me and has interested me over the last decade or so is reading about how it is that our industrial base got this way. And by this way, I mean, you know, not as super badass as it should be right now. And there's a lot of really great books out there, but I think one place to start would be an article that appeared in Boston Review in March 2014, entitled How Finance Gutted Manufacturing. And it was written by Suzanne Berger, who was a professor at MIT. And she wrote a book called Making in America, From Innovation to Market. And so she was part of this study on industrial productivity that really focused on the manufacturing industry. And what she basically lays out in this article is how, you know, the teachers' pension fund of California ended up having a negative impact and ended up with the disintegration of Timken Company, $5 billion market cap Ohio manufacturer of bearings, power transmission, gears, and specialty steel parts. The fact that those two things can be related and the way that she lays it out really shows how short-term financial return-based decisions have negatively impacted our culture of innovation and our ability to make stuff in this country. What's really great about that article is it was received so strongly that it received a handful of responses by some other really prominent people in the industry. What I think is good about reading it today is that this is about a decade before the supply chain crisis and the sort of crisis of our internal manufacturing capability that was kicked off by the COVID pandemic. And so you can now sort of see these differing opinions and how they played out over, you know, the next several years. So that would be one that I think is really good. It's not a big time commitment, and it's really informed the way that I think about things and also the way I think about the solutions. I think to a big extent, corporations and this sort of finance-based thinking got us into this problem, and there really needs to be a more active role from the corporations and from the finance people to get us back on good footing.
We'll check it out. And I'll definitely in the show notes, link up some of the AMT research as well. I agree. Folks need to get on that newsletter. And then Ryan, one person who should be on the podcast to help us build ecosystem.
Yeah. So, wow, there's so many people, and I don't want to you know, point out any one person in particular. I mean, the coolest thing about my job is I'm just meeting these, you know, brilliant people all the time and having great conversations, not unlike the one that we've been having today. One person comes to mind that could do such a better job of me than explaining what's happening with the reshoring trend would be Harry Moser of the Reshoring Initiative. You know, he is the person that has been working on this topic for many years. And he's also, you know, when Wall Street Journal or CNN wants to know about it, they talk to him too. But he loves talking about it. And I think that he would be a great person to kind of wax poetic on, you know, what's driving and what some of the barriers are to reshoring. And I think he could give a really good picture about just how big the reshoring trend could be.
Yeah, we could go so deep on that one. We barely scratched the surface on it. Love that. And then finally, Ryan, best way for folks to reach out to you after the chat?
Probably it would be the best way. So you can find me on LinkedIn and drop me a message, and then we can kind of go from there. Be happy to get in touch with anybody who wants to reach me.
Awesome. Well, encourage listeners to do it. Help us build ecosystem, because manufacturing, we've got a lot of work to continue to ramp up what's a great thing going here, Ryan, and AMT is certainly at the center of it. So appreciate you coming on and sharing the story about what you're working on.
Oh, thanks, Ty. It's always great talking with you.